I'm Carrie Miller, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, fresh off the frontier of research into Alzheimer's. We've invited three guests who are immersed in the research, treatment, and understanding of Alzheimer's disease. A couple of facts here for context. Alzheimer's accounts for between 60 to 80% of all dementia cases. It's caused by proteins or plaques that build up in the brain. More on that in a moment, because, of course, it's more complex than that. New research shows that African Americans appear to be at greater risk for dementia and Alzheimer's, and we're going to talk about why. And as you know, there is no cure. But we want to talk about your best avenues of prevention. Our roundtablers today, Dr. Ron Peterson is a physician and director of the Mayo Clinic's Alzheimer's Disease Research Center up from Rochester. Welcome, Ron. Good to have you here.
Thanks very much, Carrie.
Phyllis Farrell is vice president of global Alzheimer's disease for Lilly, and she's with us from Indianapolis. And Phyllis, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, thanks to let me join.
And Dr. Michael Rosenblum is with us, director of the Center for Memory and Aging for Health Partners. In the studio, welcome. Good
Thanks.
To have you here.
Thanks very much, Carrie. Great to be here.
Our first names, all cool with everybody?
Perfect.
Even though we've got a lot of
absolutely.
Doctors here? Okay. I know you all know each other, too. Ron, to come back to you, to the physiology of Alzheimer's for a moment, and to put this in layman's terms, protein fragments build up in the gaps between nerve cells. What else should we understand about that?
Well, the definition of Alzheimer's disease is really that there are these proteins in the brain. The proteins are amyloid, which make up the plaques in the brain, and tau, the protein that makes up the tangles in the brain. That defines the disease. When somebody passes away, you look at the brain under the microscope at a time of autopsy, and you see these plaques and tangles.
Can I ask you what it looks like on an autopsy?
Yes. The pathologists will stain the brain with certain chemicals, and the plaques show up as sort of starburst-type brownish figures, depending on the particular stain. And the tangles look like little flame-shaped proteins that are inside the nerve cells. So they're very characteristic. Pathologists are very expert at picking them up, and it's undeniable.
Michael, is there a reason that some people who may have these plaques are not necessarily susceptible to getting Alzheimer's disease or dementia, and some people are? Is that understood?
There are some theories. We don't know 100%. But there is a concept known as cognitive reserve, mm-hmm. and that has to do with the density of the neural networks in the brain. And in certain individuals who lead lives where they're more active cognitively, physically, socially, they may have a greater density of these networks and therefore greater cognitive reserve. And as a result, it takes more pathology, amyloid plaques and tangles in the brain to lead to symptoms. So potentially there are patients who have these changes in the brain but don't manifest clinical symptoms because of this cognitive reserve. That's one popular theory.
Phyllis, I was curious about whether those people end up being important in the kind of drug research that Lilly is engaged in when it comes to Alzheimer's and dementia.
Well, absolutely. One of the things that's really important for us when we do drug research and development of an investigational medicine that'll hopefully actually get to a patient someday is that we actually treat people in those trials that represent the real world. And so we look to make sure that we have a broad range of individuals in terms of, you know, education background, which is one of the best representatives we have of cognitive reserve right now, although certainly imperfect, but also in terms of people of color. You mentioned African Americans, women, gender has a big impact here. So we try very hard to make sure that we have a diverse population in studies. That isn't always easy to do. In fact, I'll go on record in saying it's extremely difficult to do.
Really? Why?
But that's always our goal.
Why is that so difficult?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of the studies end up having a very high educated population. And so you end up with a bias, if you will, of people who have lots and lots of education, more than your average American or your average European, depending on where you're doing the studies. So I think that's probably the folks that there's a bias of who goes and searches out studies. And then also there's been quite a bit of research in people of color, specifically African Americans, and why they might choose not to participate in a study, and how it's so very, very important that we get data that's representative of them as well to make sure that the medicines that we're studying will work in all of our patients, all of our customers.
So, Ron, does that end up being extremely important when you're trying to understand the external factors that may be influential in the development of Alzheimer's disease, is making sure you are representing the spectrum of people?
We think that's very important. Phyllis has brought up important issues regarding drug development. We're doing a study, actually, down in Rochester here at the Mayo Clinic, where we have randomly sampled people from our community. So rather than just taking people who respond to advertisements, newspaper ads, and the like, we, in fact, are randomly sampling. So we're asking them, would you be interested in participating in our study? And so we've been following people now for about 13, 14 years in the community who are sort of aging in place. So these are individuals who are not necessarily selected because of any biological predisposition to this disease or that disease. They can have high blood pressure, they can have diabetes, they can have all the other features. But we're studying them to try to get a picture of what the disease looks like in people as they evolve.
Michael, how does hypertension, since Ron just brought up high blood pressure, how does hypertension, what do you know about how big of a factor it is in the development of dementia or Alzheimer's?
Well, you know, we know that hypertension is a major risk factor for stroke. And we know that patients who have uncontrolled hypertension, it leads to changes in the brain. And you can have what's known as cerebrovascular disease, essentially hardening of the arteries. As a result, you end up with, you know, small injury to the brain. There's what's known as a vascular dementia, which is the extreme case where patients have really bad uncontrolled hypertension. And as a result, that's the major driving factor of the dementia. Now, we know with Alzheimer's disease, it's pretty rare to get pure Alzheimer's disease as the major cause of the patient's progressive cognitive decline and dementia. So it's often a combination of some cerebrovascular disease in the brain as well as the Alzheimer's neurodegenerative process.
So again, just a layman's question here. The injury that is sustained from prolonged hypertension, from years of having high blood pressure mm-hmm. that isn't treated, what opens opportunity in some ways for these plaques to move in? Or am I just making this way too simplistic?
On one process, you have Alzheimer's disease where you have plaques and tangles, which is a neurodegenerative process. And on the second end of things, you have cerebrovascular disease.
Uh-huh.
The major risk factor of that is hypertension.
Okay.
But we know that the majority of the patients that we see where there are autopsies, they often have a combination of this neurodegenerative pathology of Alzheimer's plaques and tangles and some of this cerebrovascular disease, and which hypertension is a major risk factor for.
Okay.
Now, you know, there's a famous physician, his name's Vladimir Hutchinsky. He'll get up on stage at these conferences and say, after you're aged over 65, you're going to have dementia due to one of these two things, or perhaps both. It's either, you know, an Alzheimer's neurodegenerative process or due to stroke or a combination of the two.
You mean it's inevitable? That's what he's saying?
It's quite
over 65?
It's quite common over 65.
Do your studies bear that out?
I think that's right. When somebody in their late 70s or 80s dies with some degree of cognitive impairment, it's likely they have, as Mike said, plaques and tangles, but they also have vascular disease. They have other proteins called things like TDP-43, alpha-synuclein. So the most common cause of cognitive impairment in late life is a combination of factors.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation among our roundtablers about research, treatment, and understanding of Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Ron Peterson with us here from Mayo, Phyllis Farrell with us here from Lilly, and Dr. Michael Rosenblum with us from the Center for Memory and Aging, getting a sense of them, starting out here with just a better understanding of what Alzheimer's is, and then talking about some of the things that influence the development of dementia and Alzheimer's. Phyllis, I want to come to you on this drug development experiment or experience that Lilly had with this drug nicknamed Sola. Is that right?
That's right. That's our baby.
Okay. So it looked like it was going to have a lot of promise. for early diagnosis of Alzheimer's. First, I want to talk to you about the early diagnosis, and then I'm going to come back to what happened with the drug development. Why so focused on early diagnosis?
So I think what's really, really important here is how far we have come scientifically just in the last, say, 5 to 10 years. 10 years ago, the plaques and tangles that Dr. Peterson, Ron, was talking about, you could really only see under a microscope, and there just aren't a lot of people that volunteer for brain biopsy these days. So we've had some pretty huge progress in the field with some diagnostic therapies that allow us to actually see that amyloid and plaque in the brain, mm-hmm. in a living brain. So essentially, it's part of a PET scan, and you're just injected with a drug that binds to the plaque and lights up under the camera. And the importance of that is we learned that actually those plaques and tangles begin forming 20 to 30 years before the actual advent of symptoms.
Wow.
And so what we learned from that, because of course until then, most of your autopsies were people who were already symptomatic and potentially very very progressed in age, what we learned was that when you see Alzheimer's disease, certainly in what you and I might think of in a long-term care setting, someone who, you know, can no longer feed themselves or remember their grandchildren, they're pretty advanced in the disease. And so, in fact, very advanced in the disease. So what the research is starting to show is that if we're going to really slow down that neurodegeneration, and I'll let the scientists on the call today actually explain the science behind it, but if you're going to slow those things down, you need to get involved much more early in the progression. Now, interestingly, with solanezumab or SOLA, we use the word early just to mean as soon as symptoms appear.
Yeah.
So we wanted people to be talking to their doctors when they started noticing something was wrong. And we wanted their doctors to be taking action earlier than they normally would, not take a wait-and-see approach. And what we found was it's really, really difficult in today's environment to get people to talk about Alzheimer's disease, even with their family members, let alone with their physician, and then have their physician want to take action very, very quickly rather than wait and see.
Let me come back to what happened with the drug, but this idea, Ron Peterson and Michael Rosenblum, about the fact that the foundation is already in your, 30s or 40s, already potentially being laid for the development of dementia or Alzheimer's. I can see why people don't want to talk about that, but is that where the true research around prevention or interception is headed?
I think so. If the analogy is heart disease, you don't want to wait until a person has a heart attack
right.
or heart failure. You want to treat them when their cholesterol is high. That may lead to the deposition of this plaque in the coronary arteries. The similar analogy in Alzheimer's disease is we don't want to wait till people get forgetful. We, in fact, want to intervene when people have the tendency to develop. So maybe now, as Phyllis mentioned, that we're able to detect these biomarkers, this amyloid buildup in the brain in live people when they're normal, and now we can even see the tau protein as well, this may be the time when we want to intervene and have an effect.
Does that mean screening, Michael, at some point when you're in your 30s or 40s or even before that for these proteins?
Well, yes, and I think that may be the way of the future. I believe that the biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease are going to play a greater role than the clinical symptoms for the reasons that were just described. You can see now in 2017 the dilemma that our clinicians face. So our patients may come in, the earliest detectable state is the mild cognitive impairment state, where patients are having cognitive symptoms, objective findings on the formal cognitive testing, but they're still able to function, do the everyday things like drive and grocery shop, etc. And then over time it progresses to dementia when those instrumental activities of daily living are compromised. But we cannot could detect those preclinical stages where those changes associated with the amyloid plaques and tangles are developing and the patients are still free of any symptoms.
Right.
So that's the role of the biomarkers in the future. And as Dr. Peterson alluded to, we need a way to kind of intervene early by detecting those changes. And I see that's probably the wave of the future for in terms of this disease process.
Phyllis, when we started talking about this, you said, but the trouble is what we learned about is people don't really want to talk about Alzheimer's disease. Why?
Maybe someday we'll get to a point where we're screening people in their 40s. I'm 45. Would I get screened? Do I need to be screened? That's, I think, a very far in the future state. Mm-hmm. I would just like us to take better care of people, say, at their annual Medicare wellness visit. So after age 65, it's supposed to be a requirement of individuals that are on Medicare to do an annual Medicare wellness visit. And yet that is used in this country only, say, 20 to 30% of the time. And even when it's done in those 20 to 30% of time, they're not doing a standardized cognitive test the same way they might be doing a standardized test for blood pressure or Ron mentioned cholesterol or blood sugar.
And Phyllis, what's the consequence mm-hmm. of that, though? Because at that point, if you're already showing symptoms, what I'm hearing this morning, not that there shouldn't be some kind of intervention, but it's very late if you're showing symptoms at 65 and beyond.
Right. So you had asked about solanezumab, and we had first studied that drug in mild and moderate dementia. So pretty advanced stages of Alzheimer's disease. And what we learned in the first two experiments was that we were too late. We restricted that population to someone who already had dementia. So that's not just mild cognitive impairment. They're functionally compromised. These are people who, you know, probably aren't, for example, taking themselves to doctor's appointments or managing their own calendars or balancing their checkbook. And in that population with SOLA, we did see an effect, but it was a very small effect. It wasn't big enough to make a difference in that particular trial statistically. So we've moved to even an earlier population, but that could be a population we're studying for prevention, but it could also be this mild cognitive impairment. I don't think we know at this point whether, as soon as those subtle symptoms start, whether we couldn't actually do something about it, at least slow the course of the disease. I know, having dealt with this disease in my family, having another 18, 24 months, 3 to 5 years, whatever you could do with my own family members, being able to participate in a quality of life way with us as a family, that would have been worth a lot to us. And so we'd like to be able to treat people with symptoms, not just prevention. And unfortunately, right now, we are finding them very difficult to find in the community, in the clinical community.
Just to be clear, it's great
when Ron talks about reaching out directly to the population he can access.
Phyllis, just to be clear for me, since we've mentioned this drug trial, in January you announced that SOLA had basically failed the clinical trials. But from what you're saying now, it sounds like you're back into some kind of trials with a different population. Is that right?
Yep.
Right. We were actually running several different studies with solanezumab, which is not unusual. They were both studies trying to delay the progression of Alzheimer's disease.
Okay.
But one was targeting patients who already had mild forms of dementia. And then the other is a study that we're doing in partnership with the National Institutes of Health called the A4 study, which is actually looking at people who have these amyloid plaques in their brains but don't yet have any cognitive symptoms that we can detect objectively.
I want to ask our two physicians here whether this is among the small number of medications that you really had hope for, and whether it is indeed quite frustrating that drug development is not happening more quickly and more effectively. No fault of maybe the pharmaceutical companies, mm-hmm. but just an indication of how difficult this is. Michael,
certainly.
What would you say?
I mean, all my patients who come to me are looking for, you know, a magic bullet.
Of course.
And I've seen drug trial after drug trial fail. And it is frustrating, but we also have to think about Alzheimer's as a more complex disease than most of the other chronic diseases that we're used to treating. So let's think of it this way. Are you going to be more successful treating, let's say, a localized cancer versus a cancer that has spread and metastasized to other parts of the body? And so ultimately, you want to treat the disease when it's at its most localized. And we're trying to do the same with Alzheimer's disease, essentially, when looking at the brain. So the population, the right population, is a major factor. And this is a totally logical progression to move to an earlier clinically detectable state, that is the mild cognitive impairment or prodromal Alzheimer's population. And so this is makes a perfect amount of sense to me, and I believe also the scientific community. And I think a lot of us are waiting with bated breath to see the results from these studies.
Yeah, Ron, where do you come in on this?
I think from a public health perspective, because of the enormous size of the disease and the problem, that we really have to focus on prevention, treating it earlier. But that doesn't mean we abandon the people who have symptomatic disease. There are millions of them out there, and so there are drugs being developed for that purpose as well.
What is it, if you could describe what it is, I hear your cancer analogy here, Michael, what it is that continues to kind of defy the expectations of the researchers? I mean, what is it?
I think one aspect of it is that, as Mike was saying, there's not a single target there.
Okay.
So it's not like there's one cell that fails in the brain. If we can replace that cell, we'll fix it. It's a system failure. So neural systems degenerate over time. So it's much more complex than that. And as we were saying earlier, it's not a single entity, not a single protein, one or two or three. It's a variety of proteins that actually affect the disease. Nevertheless, we still have to approach it from one protein at a time. So SOLA is aimed at amyloid. Very important early on in the disease, but we need others to follow.
Phyllis, tell me candidly what it was like in January at the company, where I'm sure a lot of people were pretty invested in seeing that this thing would work. Just emotionally, what was it like?
I'm not going to lie. It was devastating. We have folks that had been working on this molecule since 2004 was when it first went into humans. And I have an 11-year-old son. So, you know, when you look at your son and realize you've been developing the molecule as long as you've developed him, this was not a job for people anymore. This was truly a calling. And we came back actually in January, shortly after the start of the year, right back at it. We've got a pipeline that has multiple molecules in development, several in late stage, eight in humans. We have diagnostic tracers that we're working on, both for amyloid and the tau one that that Ron mentioned. And we have a whole bunch of patients that are still waiting on us. So we're scientists. We dive into the data. You learn a lot. I mean, that's the thing I think that this field has really been marked with, is just an explosion of scientific understanding, and then you go at the next trial more informed, and that's where we are today.
Ron, Phyllis mentioned that this is, she's seen Alzheimer's in her family. I can hear the conviction and the commitment in her voice as she talks about this. What's your connection with this kind of work? You've spent a long time of your career doing this.
Yes, many, many years, actually, probably 30, I'm afraid to say almost 40 years that I've been dealing with these kinds of issues. And I've seen the problem grow over time, such that if you go to any kind of meeting of people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and you ask how many of you have been touched by Alzheimer's disease, either in your family, friends, neighbors, whatever, almost everybody raises his or her hand. So this kind of problem will, in fact, bankrupt the healthcare system. We've been doing some stuff in Washington working on this. And the thinking is it's the most costly disease that we deal with in this country. It exceeds cancer. It exceeds heart disease. This is the most costly disease. So consequently, we can't turn the other way. We really have to deal with this head on. Fortunately, from a federal perspective, we've been making ground on funding for research. When we started the National Alzheimer's Plan in 2011, the funding for Alzheimer's disease was about $450 million. As of this year, it's now $1.4 billion. Mm. So we've made those kinds of efforts. And in fact, there's another $400 million proposed for FY18.
Is this in your family, though?
I had a grandmother. Had a grandmother with Alzheimer's disease later in her life, and, you know, she just wilted away like everybody else.
Michael, how about you?
Yeah, so actually my grandmother, maternal grandmother, she was a Holocaust survivor and probably one of the strongest persons I've ever met. and she succumbed to Alzheimer's disease. And to see somebody who essentially was a self-made woman, came to the United States from Poland, started her own business, was successful enough to send both of her kids to college, and then to see her kind of in the state where she just couldn't remember me, it was devastating.
Phyllis, is it a grandparent in your family?
Yeah, actually, my father-in-law passed away of Alzheimer's disease, and we were somewhat blessed because his cardiovascular health deteriorated before his Alzheimer's disease. So he forgot me, but he never forgot my husband. And then my father is suffering from a longstanding neurodegenerative disease, and he's had about 7 diagnoses now, including Alzheimer's, although
wow.
I don't think that's actually what he has. And you can't imagine the irony of that when I have responsibility for a diagnostic and I can't get it to my dad because it's not paid for by
wow.
Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why this is such a personal and professional battle for me, and it's why I want to talk about getting into research and getting an early diagnosis. You asked about the frustration of scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm blessed to work with a lot of wonderful scientists, but I'll tell you what my frustration is. I fully believe that there is today in the clinical research community a drug that will make a dent in this disease. I don't know that there's a cure that's already in clinical research, but I am almost positive that there is a treatment that is in clinical research today. And the only thing that's slowing us down is the ability to recruit these studies. They just take so long to recruit. And when you think about the healthcare crisis that Ron talked about, there are definitely people out there who might want to participate in the study either for themselves or to be a part of the solution. And getting the word out there that there's so much hope in this research and that we've made so much progress scientifically, I think is a really important thing. I have never had someone come to me and say they wish they'd enrolled in a study later. All of them have said to me, I wish I'd enrolled in a study earlier. It's been a really positive experience for people.
Well, then I think we should, as we go to the news break here, talk about how you, if you're, you know, convinced by the conversation that we're having, inspired today, how do you get into one of these studies?
Absolutely. There are several resources that people can search out. One is clinicaltrials.gov.
Okay.
That lists all of the trials that are available in the country. The Alzheimer's Association at ALZ.org has a link on their website called Trial Match, and that will match people to various trials. But call your healthcare provider as well. Health Partners, Indiana University, the Mayo Clinic, all of these institutions have clinical trials available.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about where research, treatment, and understanding of Alzheimer's disease is today. Dr. Ron Peterson with us from Mayo, Dr. Michael Rosenblum with us from the director for the Center for Memory and Aging, and Phyllis Farrell with us from Lilly, where she's vice president of global Alzheimer's disease. When we come back, we haven't talked about the genetic component to this, and we kind of skipped over this research out of Wisconsin and some other places that looked at people with color who have Alzheimer's and some of the factors that may be influencing the development of Alzheimer's. So we'll talk about that on the other side of news, but first to this.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. Senior U.S. officials say the U.S. is pulling roughly 60% of its staff out of Cuba and warning American travelers not to visit due to specific attacks that have harmed U.S. diplomats there. The officials say the U.S. is ordering all non-essential staff in the embassy in Havana to leave, along with all family members. Only emergency personnel will remain. President Trump today is promoting his plan for a sweeping rewrite of the tax code at a meeting of the National Association of Manufacturers. The president and congressional Republicans this week released the outlines of a nearly $6 trillion tax cut plan. It reduces taxes, simplifies tax brackets, and nearly doubles the standard deduction. The White House says President Trump will take an extensive five-nation trip to the Asia-Pacific region in November. The White House says Trump will travel to Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. The administration says Trump's visit will strengthen the international resolve to confront the North Korean threat. Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price says he will pay about $52,000 to cover the cost of his travel on charter flights taken on government business. Price is promising to fly commercial from now on. President Trump has criticized Price's flying habits. Two straight days of rock falls at Yosemite National Park have left one person dead, two injured, and a mountain climber stunned. A huge hunk of granite came off of El Capitan yesterday, even bigger than a large piece of rock that fell off on Wednesday. The second left just one man injured, but the first one killed a British man and injured his wife. Coming up in the 11 o'clock hour on NPR News, the lasting legacy of the Vietnam War. Dwahli Saikau Tau and Tom Weber lead the discussion. The time now is 10:37.
I'm Dwahli Saikau Tau. Coming up at 11, we'll look at the lasting legacy of the Vietnam War from the perspective of those who lived in Laos and Cambodia, countries that bordered Vietnam. Their voices you won't hear in the Vietnam War PBS specials now airing across the country. Join us for that at 11.
Programming supported by the Fitzgerald Theater, bringing the radio experience to the stage with programs like A Prairie Home Companion, Talking Volumes, and National Geographic Live. More information is online at fitzgeraldtheater.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. Today we're talking with three guests who are immersed in the research and the treatment and the understanding of Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Ron Peterson from Mayo, Dr. Michael Rosenblum for the Center for Memory and Aging, and Phyllis Farrell with us, where she's Vice President of Global Alzheimer's Disease for Lilly. We want to talk a bit about the stigma and why, I guess, more families, Michael, don't acknowledge that this is the shadows a lot of families, and that this is something that many, many of us are going to have to confront. What's the stigma around Alzheimer's?
Well, Alzheimer's disease is a condition that leads to progressive decline in memory.
Yes.
And memory is kind of part of the self. It's kind of how we perceive
each
other.
It's intrinsic to your identity.
Exactly.
Right?
And so there is stigma and embarrassment about having the diagnosis. There's a concern about whether or not the affected individual will be able to continue to contribute to the family, to society. And also, we know that the brain's affected in this condition, and so the brain gives us insight into whether or not we have a memory disorder. And a lot of times, my patients are just not aware of it. And so that also is another kind of complicating factor in getting patients to the clinician's office to receive a diagnostic workup. Now, we have those challenges, and then there's the challenges on the side of the clinician, where we don't have a perfect blood test to make the diagnosis. And a lot of clinicians may get intimidated about the whole idea of delivering the diagnosis. And so you have this growing chronic disease that's going to overwhelm our healthcare system. But we have patients who are not getting to the doctor on time. We have clinicians who feel overwhelmed in giving the diagnosis. We know that about 50% of patients who present to their primary clinician with a underlying dementia don't actually have that diagnosis communicated to them.
Really? What? So you come in with symptoms, you get a test, and often you are not told what your status is on dementia or what?
Well, they may have an underlying condition, but for some reason or another, the workup is not done. It's overlooked in the process. So there may or may not be a screening test that is administered at that time.
Okay.
And for, I believe it was Phyllis who mentioned this before, that cognitive screening is not routinely done during the annual healthcare checkup.
Right, right.
So as a result, we have these problems on the side of the patient and also the challenges on the side of the healthcare system as well. And one of the programs that the Health Partner Center for Memory and Aging started in partnership with the University of Minnesota is this program known as the Partners in Dementia Program. And what we were doing is pairing up first-year medical students with our patients who have early-stage Alzheimer's disease. And by doing that, you accomplish several things. So number one, you empower the individual with memory loss as a mentor. So, You know, one of the most important things that I do as a clinician is educate medical students and residents. And now we're taking somebody in the community with this disease and allowing them to participate in this really important work. On the other hand, you take these first-year medical students, expose them early when they're very impressionable to these individuals who have Alzheimer's disease, and they get passionate about it. They see that these individuals are beyond just a person with memory loss, and that helps to destigmatize the disease. They become more comfortable having these conversations. In fact, it's a requirement from the University of Minnesota that they spend 4 hours a month for a period of 1 year to complete this program. So they're having a lot of time together. And they're talking about anything ranging from the experience of the diagnosis to what are your favorite hobbies? Where'd you go to college? And so there have been some amazing relationships that have kind of been created through this program. And it's just been an incredible program. And I hope that we're going to have more clinicians in the state of Minnesota who are better at making the diagnosis, more comfortable having the conversations. Yeah. And we know that there's a dearth of clinicians who are going to professions like neurology, psychiatry that involve dementia care. We hope to kind of shift that trend.
Ron, it is not hard to imagine that medical students and doctors are afraid to have these difficult conversations with patients. I mean, I've done many shows about that. What do you say to the young students and the younger doctors who are training in this field about compassion and clarity around this?
I think there is an element of nihilism, unfortunately, among us as physicians, thinking that there's nothing we can really do about this disease. We don't have the treatment. We don't have the diabetes medication. So why do we want to bring this up? Why do we want to make our patient uncomfortable? I think this is an education problem for us that we really need to get out there, reach to these primary care people, and let them know that we can do something for these people. There are things we can do from a lifestyle perspective, certainly can help people plan for the future, which is important. And I think those types of interventions now, in lieu of that therapy that's out there, and of course, alert them to the notion that they can get involved in clinical trials. Clinical trials is the way we're really going to treat this disease and deal with it down the road. In cancer, it's not uncommon for people who come to their physician, get diagnosed with cancer, and say, here are the treatments, but oh, by the way, there's also a clinical trial. We can put you in this, we can do that. We don't have that in Alzheimer's, that attitude in Alzheimer's disease, and we need to develop that.
Phyllis, I wanted to ask you about this research that I mentioned that's come out of Wisconsin and some other places about that looks at people of color with Alzheimer's, showing that the stress of an impoverished environment can maybe be influential on the risk of Alzheimer's. How important is that kind of work, looking at these, I guess, environmental issues to maybe what Lilly is doing in drug development?
No, I think it's a great question. I think we know actually definitively through research that there are things that can impact your outcome with cognitive issues. And you know, you mentioned stress. Certainly we know sleep has a big impact. There's been a great study out of Europe that looks at the impact of diet and exercise. And so when you think about communities at the African-American community, the Hispanic community, that have notoriously high rates of things like diabetes, and obviously Lilly's a big diabetes company, you see a lot of the same factors will have an impact on their progression with Alzheimer's disease. And I think it's extremely important. This comes back even to what Ron was just talking about. There is something that you can do as a doctor today to have this conversation. And you can have a conversation with your patient when they're starting to have cognitive issues, or maybe they have worries about cognitive issues because of history in their family. You can start having a conversation with them about things that they can do today to help stave off the disease. And I don't want to suggest that you can blueberry your way out of Alzheimer's disease, but there are things that you can do around diet and exercise and sleep and reducing your stress and staying very active. You know, often sometimes with when someone's concerned about their cognition, their world gets very small. And that's about the opposite of what we should be doing. We should be becoming more active and trying to learn new things. And I think, unfortunately, at least in the United States, all of these risk factors are much, much higher in the populations of color. And it's something that we need to make sure that primary care physicians, family practice physicians are educated about. These aren't bad doctors that aren't giving the diagnosis. You know, Michael was talking about the disclosure rate of an Alzheimer's diagnosis. Yeah, these aren't bad doctors. They could very well be in a rural community like the one I live in, and they say, boy, I don't want to give this diagnosis because it'll impact the whole family. And yet you could be having a conversation with them that could help the whole family with some of these environmental factors, at least temporarily until we can actually find some of those more pharmaceutical solutions.
Ron?
Yes, the National Academies of Science put out a report just this past June doing what's called an evidence-based medicine review of the literature, which just means that it was a very thorough review of the literature with a high bar. And this was proposed by the National Institute on Aging, asking the question, is there anything we can do as citizens to prevent cognitive aging, the development of mild cognitive impairment, or dementia? And the literature review revealed there may be three factors. One is, as Phyllis was indicating, cognitive activity, cognitive training. There was a very prominent study that was reported indicating that people who were trained with certain types of cognitive activities, memory, reasoning, speed of processing, in fact, had a lower rate of developing cognitive impairment 2 and maybe 5 and 10 years later. A second factor was the treatment of blood pressure, and particularly treatment of blood pressure in midlife. That is, when you're in your 40s and 50s, watch your blood pressure because it can have an impact on your thinking later in life. The third factor was physical exercise. Those people who got out there and actually were physically active. And we don't need marathon running here. We can talk about brisk walking for the number we throw out there is like 150 minutes a week. 50 minutes three times, 30 minutes five times. That can have an effect on lowering your risk for cognitive impairment.
Michael, you know what I'm thinking as I listen to what Ron says? All of those things are good for probably fending off all kinds of disease. We know this. Why can't people like you and I don't know, people like me get more people to invest that way? And these are pretty simple things into their health.
Yeah, I mean, we've been trying to do that with every patient we see in our clinic. So we have this book called the Living Well Workbook that we put together with the Alzheimer's Association, evidence-based about all those things Ron just mentioned, and we give it out to everybody. And I'm sure only a small percentage of people actually go through this. And as a result of that, we're actually working at Health Partners on kind of a wellness program where we have like a trainer next to somebody as they're exercising. And we're trying to kind of innovate in those various areas.
But you don't need a trainer to know that going out for a 30-minute walk five times. I can't tell you how many conversations we've had where it's like, it really isn't rocket science to do everything potentially you can do.
I'm going to build on your point there. And this is something where I think actually our society can be helped by the fear that comes from Alzheimer's disease. And here's what I mean by that.
Okay.
We know that for people over 50, 55, Alzheimer's disease is their number one fear. It's not cancer. It's Alzheimer's disease, and it's for all the things that you've heard about today. You can always expect that you won't be able to run that marathon, although I couldn't run one today. But you never expect that you're going to lose your identity that comes with your memory, your relationships, who you are. So people are very afraid of Alzheimer's disease. We've been talking about diet and exercise for a long time in this country as something that staves off other diseases. Maybe if we let people know that it can actually potentially slow things down in Alzheimer's disease, or at least make sure that you have a better outcome if you do face the disease, maybe this is what we need for our country and other countries. The World Health Organization has been talking about Alzheimer's disease as one of those non-communicable diseases. And these are things that maybe Alzheimer's disease is the motivation that we need to try to start taking some of these actions around our health.
Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, I think those are great ideas. And, you know, I spend quite a bit of time in clinic and I get to observe human behavior, and I'm having the conversations with my patients about stopping smoking or reduce your alcohol intake. And, you know, these are human beings. And
are you telling me it's going in one ear and out the other?
Sometimes
often?
It does.
Yeah. How specific do you get about, I just want to let you know, if you continue to smoke like this and drink like this, your risk of developing Alzheimer's, you know, what do you say?
Yeah, I pretty much tell them that, you know, if you're smoking, I mean, this is essentially, you know, you're basically reducing the length of your life. This tobacco is horrible for all different bodily systems. And then alcoholism in the setting of someone who already has a cognitive impairment. And I mentioned that this is only going to make things worse. It's going to hasten the process. But again, you know, old habits die hard. And so if you have an individual who's been doing these things, being physically active, cognitively active their entire life,
yeah,
these conversations are easier than someone who has to completely do an about face, you know, in their 50s or so. It's a challenge. This is just the reality that I face in clinic. And, you know, it would be easier if there was something that was immediate. Like, so for instance, if someone had a pain and they had to take a medicine to alleviate that pain, they're more than likely to take that medicine. Hypertension is very similar to the Alzheimer's dilemma. You don't really feel hypertension until it's too late.
Right.
Same thing with Alzheimer's disease.
Ron?
I think behavior is difficult to change, really, and not that it's immutable, but in fact, you look at smoking. We've known this since the 60s, and yet there are people who continue to smoke. So it is a problem, but I think we're making some headway. The way I sometimes approach it is, look, you've got genetic risks. That's a deck of cards you were dealt with by mom and dad. You're not going to do much about that. But there are some modifiable things you can do, and these are the health issues, the behavioral issues. And in fact, sometimes I say aging need not be a passive process. That is, you don't just sit around and let it happen, but you can actually influence it by exercise and behavior. And I think that, like what Phyllis was saying, is that when people start to realize that losing cognitive skill later on in life is a big deal. Cancer's bad, heart disease is bad, but when you lose your person, that's a bigger deal.
I don't know, Phyllis. I want to believe that's true, but then, you know, you can tell people lung cancer is really ugly. If you continue to smoke, you're really opening the door to lung cancer. And as Ron says, look at how many fewer people smoke, but a lot of people still smoke. It seems like making that connection between fear of a disease and the behavior that may lead in part to that disease, it's not a tight enough connection these days.
Well, it certainly isn't easy. Believe me, I have a 48-year-old husband that I'm still trying to get him to to manage his diet better,
and I live with him
and am less effective. but that's why, Carrie, we're not giving up on the investigational medicines that we're exploring. We know, once again, that we aren't going to make the difference with diet and exercise for everybody, even if you obeyed all the rules. Sadly, Alzheimer's disease will still win. So that's one of the reasons at Lilly, we aren't giving up on the research. We're going to learn everything we can from the research we've done. We benefit greatly from a very collaborative community between the academic scientists and the other pharma companies. And this is not the time to give up. This is the time to double down. We have made so much progress in the science just in the last 5 to 10 years that I really believe we're at a tipping point, that the lives that our parents have faced taking care of their parents, our grandparents, the lives we have faced taking care of our parents, I really believe that our children won't have to face that with us, and or certainly our grandchildren won't have to face those challenges with our children. But we've got to move faster, and we've got to make sure that the research moves at the fastest clip possible.
Michael, what do you think?
So this past summer, I attended the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in London, and this is the biggest dementia meeting that's annual
in the world.
Yes, in the world, and it presents the latest discoveries. And there was a presentation that really got me excited, and this was delivered by Clifford Jack and a panel of speakers. Clifford Jack's at the Mayo Clinic, and he was talking about the proposed novel criteria, research criteria for Alzheimer's disease in the future. And what he talked about was a criteria that is very much heavily based on biomarkers and kind of cuts out the various clinical dilemmas that we've faced and discussed earlier in this session. And I think through the research in this area, we're going to be able to diagnose this disease earlier. And it's going to become less abstract, more concrete. We're going to start seeing it just like cancer. And once we start doing that, I think we're going to come up with better treatments and management interventions.
Ron, what do you think?
Alzheimer's disease should be defined by its biologic features, the plaques and tangles, as opposed to how's your memory and how you're thinking, how you're doing in the general environment, and that it's much like cancer then. So a prostate biopsy reveals cancer. You have prostate cancer irrespective of your clinical state. You may be normal. Similarly with Alzheimer's disease. If you have plaques and tangles in the brain that we can now see with the new biomarkers, the PET scans, you have Alzheimer's disease. And I think that kind of thinking is going to move the field forward.
Phyllis, so great to have you with us today from Indianapolis. I'm really glad you had time to join the panel. Really good. Thank you.
Oh, I was thrilled to be here.
And doctors, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely, Carrie. Thanks so much for bringing this topic to our attention.